staring hours.
Well, welcome everyone. If you haven't been here tonight, great to have you at the Graduate Christian Union. I'm Rob Heimberger, and here to introduce Dr. Darren Gowers, who comes to us from Portsmouth University. He's in did his doctorate at Southampton, and is now at the University of Portsmouth, where he's part of the Biomolecular Structures Group at the Institute of Biomedical and Biomolecular Sciences. So from what I understand, that the work you do is on DNA structures and how molecules find the right place to attach along a DNA structure. So he also, in a couple of months, will be my brother-in-law. Yeah. So it's great that you've come to speak to us on a really intriguing subject of gene sequencing and who I am. So if you'd join with me in welcoming Dr. Darren Gowers.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for having me. Yes, Rob is going to become my brother-in-law, and of course, as he's sitting here in the audience as well, it's a great pleasure. So I wouldn't be here unless it was for that contact over a washing up sink a while back. Gene sequencing and who I am. There are a number of issues that I'd like to chat to you about tonight. Also, we probably won't get through all of them because there are so many areas to talk about in the decade we find ourselves in, with information pouring out of DNA sequences. I'm aware that the audience are clearly, that you all are clearly graduates, some of you from sciences, probably from others from other faculties and so on, so I'm not going to be going into huge detail to lose all of you, because that's not the purpose. The title, Gene Sequencing and Who I Am, I actually dreamt up in 5 seconds. I think the title I wanted, really, probably, was Who We Are, because I'm a Christian, like you guys, and believe that God created the universe, and that he loves us and has a plan for us, of course, but when we take our work to work, how do we deal with issues that come up? And some of the things I'm going to talk about tonight are related really to this field of genomics. It's a word that has been coined relatively recently. It's to do with, you will understand that genetics has been around, classical genetics has been around for years and years and years. But genomics, what do we do with information about lots of different organisms? I think this is a whole bunch of different organisms here sitting in the same room, and of course there are bacteria all over my skin and all through us, and there are bacteria around, and there's life outside everywhere we go in the universe, or on planet Earth, there is life. So I'm going to put my talk into 3 parts. First of all, I'm going to jump off the planet and go into space briefly, but I promise not to do an impression of Brian Cox, to explain why biology really starts a long way away and a long time ago. I'm going to zoom in after that in the second, on the first main part of my talk, then the first space bit will be very short, to talk about my favourite molecule, DNA. This iconic, we've coloured it red and white here, double helix flowing through the middle of a protein DNA complex. So I'm going to talk about DNA and explain a little bit about its structure and how it's found, and why it's so crucial, and why it is that information that's contained inside DNA is allowing us to find out all sorts of interesting things about all sorts of organisms. And then I'm going to, in the second main part of my talk then, I'm going to talk about sequencing and how over the last decade, 2 decades really, the last decade particularly, the number of organisms that have had their genomes fully sequenced is now starting to shoot up. And sequencing follows a law faster than Moore's law at the moment. Those of you familiar with computing and the power of processors, every 18 months I think it is the latest one. But DNA sequencing is going up at something like every 13 or 14 months, doubling in its speed and the capacity for it to get sequences. So I just want to step back just for a moment though and tell you the big themes here, just for me as a scientist. I'm not a clever theologian, but there were guys amongst you much cleverer than I am. And once I put the talk together, I try to draw out what it is I want to try and tell you. One is that scientists are inherently curious. We always like asking questions. And for me, since my first encounter with the double helix at college in Brighton 20 years or so ago, that curiosity about understanding life at the molecules and genes and cells level has never left me. So my talk will have facts in it. I can't help but put those in, I'm afraid. But the theme is, we're God's creation, you know, his creatures. We are curious, and scientists particularly are allowed to be that. What do we do once we start generating lots of data? And physics are very good because they're the cosmology scale and particle physics scale. they're generating much more data than biology is. But biology is not that far behind in terms of the number of bases that have been sequenced, and you explain what that is. And just to mention here, the Earth is the Lord's. Everything that I talk about is to do with my field of genetics, genomics, biochemistry. It's not to do with the current state of in the Middle East and what's going on there, to do with world poverty and hunger and pollution, all the big issues. But I did want to point out that as scientists, of course, we're still stewards of his creation. And when we're finding out this new knowledge, what can we do with it? How do we use it well? And as scientists, we have to engage and be able to speak with people at church settings, and of course in academic and business settings, about our faith and how it interacts with what we find. So those are the three sort of things. So I need to take you back a long way in space and time and have a picture of stars, and of course the accepted view of about 13.5 billion years ago, which is 13,500 million years, which after a while, once Brian Cox has said it once, it just loses its capacity, doesn't it? To sort of amaze us. But the universe is full of revolving galaxies. It's just a picture from Hubble. These pictures are taken from the Hubble telescope on NASA's website. This is called the deep field view, where they pointed Hubble for a few days at a dark space of sky and just let the photons come onto the camera, see what they could find, and countless more galaxies beyond what we could even see. So the universe is full of galaxies, it's full of matter, and of course I'm not going to step onto dark matter and dark energy, but apparently there's a lot of that as well. Everywhere we look, over space is dark and cold and big and old, I think is the sort of four best ways to describe it. And this is a picture, this is M104, the Sombrero galaxy. It just shows how much dust and matter. This is actually a galaxy sideways on, it's not a star system that's exploded. And gravity has had a huge influence over the eons, and stars being born, stars that die in these supernova. It's in these reactions that fusion pressure and gravity are big enough to push protons together to make atoms that start to climb what we understand as the empirical table. So all matter is Jupiter, and I think this is Ganymede here just peeking out behind, getting taken by Hubble. All matter, everything in this room, you've heard it before, but everything came from a star. So we have to put that as a fact in our cap and realise that everything we see comes from a nuclear reactor a long way away and over many, many countless millions, of course billions of years. This is a picture taken by one of the Apollo 8 astronauts. Lose his name just for a moment, come back to me later. Earthwise, probably a very famous photo that many of you have seen before. This idea that you could blot out the only rock on which we understand that organisms exist with a thumb is I still find, spine-tinglingly exciting. Because there is biology, and of course there is life, there is everything that we understand, just in a small rocky spaceship going around a rather unremarkable yellow star. So I just wanted to bring us out and then bring back again to remind ourselves that all the biology we're about to see started off a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. So I'm going to split this talk into two parts then, talk about cells, molecules and DNA, give you an idea of size, and then talk about genomics and some of the issues that come out of it, and we'll range across gene therapy and xenotransplantation and all sorts of things. Some of you, not all of you, of course, all of us, but we won't all be dealing with these issues in our lives day to day, others of you will be doing much more interesting and practical things, of course, but understanding knowledge and understanding how we apply it is important, especially as bioscientists. So if you'll forgive me, some of it if you know, great, others just come on the journey. There's life everywhere we look, and I've told you already that if you're a humpback whale, if you're in a rainforest in Indonesia, these pictures, most of them were taken by members of staff in my department. Everywhere you look, there's life. We know that life begets life, so that there's that whole process of reproduction, and crucially, of course, within that, minor errors that are made in copying the DNA, so that generally parents and children look alike, although they don't look quite alike, so none of you look quite like your parents, but you look more like your family than the other families. There's a reticulated python that one of our lecturers took last year, but what I want to point out to you is we sort of go down in scale through life, from the very, very large onto planet Earth and down. Not so much the leaf cut around itself, but look at the structure of the leaf and the veins and the midrib. Everything that lives has a particular structure. And the structure we recognise is made up of cells. And now we're zooming in because biology becomes very, very weird once you start to get very small. It becomes quite ugly in places. And this thing eats wooden chips and wooden piers. It's called Lenoria, also known as a gribble. It's a tiny little thing. And the scale bar here, taken on a scanning electron microscope, is 100 microns. So that's 100, if you imagine taking a metre, which is about this long, dividing it up into a million pieces. Think how small each of those would be. And I've just got 100 of those together. That's how long it is there. So these organisms are getting very small. Biology starts to lose an immediate idea of, you know, what it looks like. It looks relatively ugly to us, these little things with quibbles. So the structures, though, maintain order. So as you go down below the level at which our eyes can resolve shapes and sizes, we come across this at the spinnerets of a spider, the back end of a spider, and this is the beta silk fibroin here, which comes out. It's false coloured, so it doesn't come out blue. It comes out of these spinnerets with these structures, and upon meeting the air, it actually sets. So if you've ever seen a spider just drop with its drag line straight out, it's ejecting liquid protein, which is becoming solid behind it. So Spider-Man, eat your heart out. So these structures are really, to us again, they look a bit weird. You can see tangles of the silk here behind. Still maintain order. This is a picture, a bit fuzzy, from my colleague Dr. Schubert, with neurons that are meeting one another in an early axon scaffold in a chick. So we're at the scale of cells here. So these are individual cells, with the neurons growing out behind them, and you've got different portions of cells meeting each other, starting to signal. So remember that these are not human beings signalling, these are weird things called cells. And we don't really understand quite what makes a cell. We can tick all the things that are inside it, but it doesn't tell us how it does it, what it's doing, and why. But you can see here that there's still order on the scale of cells. This is the early part of a spinal cord, basically. Looking out at you and our skin and the faces and our hands and things, of course, we are full of dead cells on the outside. So your wonderful, beautiful faces, I'm actually looking at dead skin cells all over you there. These are keratinized epithelial cells. These are examples of what happens when you zoom in on the cells and the crevices on your finger. But there's still order here. This is keratin, which is a very fibrous protein, keeps our waterproof and so on. Very important. We can see they're joined together, they're not overlapping, they come together in tissues, come together in sheets, and you make this organised thing called an organism. Now I just want to zip down one more stage to a cell, and this is the magic moment. Some of you probably recognise this moment when one becomes two, sort of the opposite of marriage, I suppose. One becoming two, mitosis, where the cell is signalled to divide, and of course cancers when this problem goes all screwy. And you can get problems with cell division where cell division doesn't just stop, it keeps going again and again. And as scientists, it's really interesting to work out, why do cells keep dividing? When do they stop dividing? And this is the process. You can see the chromosomes, the white DNA here, lined up along the plate of the cell. And then these pink sections here, these microtubules, literally pull, and they pull the two chromosomes apart, and the new cells separate here down the middle eventually. But at the 10 millionths of a metre scale again, so imagine that metre and a million pieces, just 10 of them there, not 100. That's how small cells are. In fact, you can get much smaller cells than that. It's a typical human type cell.
Okay, so this is just a human cell?
Yes, these are human cells, yeah, the pitch taken in the department. So a normal epithelial cell. But it's even weirder than that, because cells are the things that you understand, of course, they're the things that they're full of chemicals and they're the bags of life. Inside cells, it gets even better because the cell is not an open, watery bag with a nucleus. It contains molecules that still have shape, structure. They look weird to us. This is the same molecule with a cutaway section on the right, and this is called the GroEL/GroES chaperoning complex. It's a hanger in which proteins that are unfolded, chains, come in here. The cap stays on. This is the cap structure at the top. The proteins folds up into a beautiful three-dimensional shape. So I'll use that word in a pejorative sense, but beautiful meaning it's a functional molecule, and these are enzymes, proteins that do things. And then once that protein has folded up, it's been sequestered away inside here where nothing else can get to it, nothing can snip it to cut it, the top pops open and the protein leaves, and the next one will come in the bottom. So it's just an example of a machine, a device, and cells are full of machines and devices. Here's another device that allows us to breathe dioxygen in the air. This is hemoglobin, of course, you can see. It's made up of four parts, a white and a blue, and a grey and this other blue behind. Two subunits back to back, each of them has a structure of chemicals which allows hemoglobin, allows oxygen to bind, and the binding and release of oxygen is modulated by this thing flexing. So please think of biology in 3D, but it's never a flat textbook page where you just look at a structure or a wall or a cell. It's a three-dimensional thing inside the cell working. There's a big question, and has been around for a long time, hundreds of years really since people started thinking about what is it about life that allows us to replicate. And it was a story that was unfolded in the 1950s in another university town. And it was really a success story of a woman in science, Rosalind Franklin, who, for various reasons, had her data stolen by this chap, Maurice Wilkins, a bit naughty, and she was doing some very interesting work where she was taking strands of this material, deoxyribonucleic acid, and just basically combing them, like comb our hair, hat hair at the moment. It sort of lines it up, roughly, and if you comb long molecules of DNA, and then you fire a beam of X-rays, which are extraordinarily bright and intense electromagnetic waves, spectrum waves, through these combed fibres of DNA, you get this weird black spots which occurs when the X-rays bang into an atom and get deflected off at a different angle. So this is a piece of photographic film. This is one of the very famous early X-ray crystallography, X-ray fibre diffraction patterns that Franklin took. And the important thing are these big black arcs on the outside. Now, the long and short of it was that her data was fit beautifully by two young men, Francis Crick and James Watson, because they like playing with Lego. So that's a really key thing. We make sure we always play lots of Lego. They built up a structure to explain this strange X structure, this X-ray picture that's just fading down behind here. And they came up with the icon of the 20th century, the famous double helix. All of you know this. Just briefly to explain, it's a double helix because if you follow this yellow red strand, it goes around behind the board, back up here, and there's another one here coming in behind the board, round over the top of the mound. So it's two helices, it's a helix, but two strands that are wound together. And again, that's a beautiful biblical reference, of course, to marriage, but I don't see it quite like this. But it's nice sometimes to read into things, the structure of beauty at all levels of life. So DNA is a molecule really that we know a lot about now. And the important point is if you unwrap DNA and pull it out, it's full of information. And this is really where I just wanted to jump off into the talk properly. So we've zoomed in on life, cells. I've told you about cells being very, very small. Life being weird on inside cells. So if you were inside a cell, if this was a woman's cell, we'd be jam-packed in with all sorts of organelles and molecules bouncing around off us. It'd be a horrible place to be inside a cell. But here at the heart of the cell is the DNA. And the information, the parts that contain information, are these chemical structures here. So this is an adenine here, which is bonded to a partner molecule called the thymine, and an A always goes with a T. So there's another A here, always goes with a T. And this is what Watson and Crick worked out, and that G, guanine, always goes with a C. And that's how simple biologists are. If we remember A with T, G with C, that's all we need to know. The thing is, DNA is essentially a one-dimensional molecule. It's a huge amount of length. It's all length, with hardly any depth or width at all. Just a few nanometers, tiny, tiny fractions. It's all length, because it all contains runs of these things called bases. Each A, G, T, and C is called a base. And the information runs one way down one strand, and the other strand runs the other way. So they're actually paired, they're complementary paired, complementary in the way that they're paired. And the information can be read off both strands. So if I knew only the sequence of this A, G, T, C, I could immediately, without having to see that strand, say, I've got C, it must be G. T, it must be an A, and so on. So you can see, this is Watson and Crick's famous comment in 1953 when they said it's not escaped our attention. We can copy DNA. So that's quite a rapid gallop. Apologies for that. Some of it familiar to many of you, perhaps not all of it, but just those themes of the scale of life being old, and that life on this planet was made up of organisms and we're made up of cells. DNA is the molecule that contains information. So I want to move on to talk about genomes, because that's where the science moved on to 10, 20 years ago. Genomes, and what are they? Well, we'll start with the data storage problem. So we'll start here with two comparisons of how you can store information if you're an organism. So one thing is that you could store information by writing, and of course all undergraduates have to write essays, and writing things down takes quite a long time. This is the prism. It's a six-sided piece of wood of King Sennacherib, or King Sennacherib, who was an Assyrian king about 700 years BC. And he thought he was so wonderful, he wrote down in his script the number of wives and the size of his kingdom, and they called cities and slaves, all sorts of stuff. I can't remember all these. It's one of these is in the British Museum, and a copy is in Chicago. And this has about 20,000 characters. So if you read the script around the size, 20,000, of course, by computing standards, that's nothing, is it? That's we can store a text file, essentially. But just consider this. This is a bacteria. This is an E. coli bacteria which has had its cell, partly its outside, slightly broken, so that the DNA that's inside it, all that stuff inside, has spilled out onto the grid of the electron microscope. And all these yellow dots are just artifacts, you can ignore them. But just attempt even to follow one of the paths. This is one continuous molecule. Trying to untangle that. That's one continuous molecule made up of those A, G, C, C and T nucleotides. It's information. So it's information here on the strand, and information here. And you've seen then that this is 4.6 million characters stored in a bacteria, which is only a few microns, a few millionths of a metre tall. This thing stands about 40 centimetres high off the ground and weighs 50 kilograms. So you can see how biology is very good at storing information. And it leads us to a problem. Because once we can start reading down these strands of DNA in a bacteria, or in a virus, or in a rat, or a yeast, or a cow, or a guinea pig, or a human, once we start reading the DNA inside, we're faced with a problem of amount of information. Most living organisms are products of their genome, of their entire stock of nucleic acid material. It doesn't distinguish completely who we are, because the environment and other factors actually can do things in the way that the DNA is controlled, the way that the DNA is expressed. And that's a field we'll maybe talk about a little bit later. But the DNA essentially is the important stuff in a cell. So the problem. So here's one of the enzymes that my group work on is an enzyme called DNA ligase. This is an enzyme that binds two ends of DNA, sticks them together, and rejoins them. So I like to think about that. I used to work on enzymes called restriction enzymes that broke DNA into pieces. But now I work on an enzyme that fixes things. I don't know if there's a metaphor in there somewhere. But look, there's 2,000 bases just in green here. Just look at the ones in green, not the other colours. 2,000 bases of AGT, CG, ACG, DCG, ACD. And once you get to a size of 2,000 for a simple enzyme, and the way it works is that the DNA here is copied, basically by a photocopying machine that runs along the DNA, makes a copy of the DNA in a type of material called messenger RNA. It's very much like DNA, but temporary. So it's a temporary piece of paper, as it were. A copy is made of the gene. And then that information in the mRNA is translated into that three-dimensional protein structure. So that's where the three-dimensional, you go from a one-dimensional DNA into a three-dimensional protein that sits in a cell that does a particular job. Hemoglobin is an example of protein. DNA ligase is another example of protein. We have about 25,000 or so proteins in human cells, give or take. So let's zoom back. I've kept this is a Word document that I've just screen printed. Same font size as before, this one here. And now I'm looking at an entire genetic complement of a simple bacteria. So 48,500 bases. You can see how much space it now takes up, going from the top left all the way to the bottom right. That's how to make lambda bacteriophage, the very simple bacteria. Used a lot in biology as a workhorse, actually, lambda bacteriophage. So there's a lot of information there. That's a genome. That's the entire complement of information inside the nucleus. In this case, inside a virus, the equivalent thing. Inside us, looks a bit more like this. These are chromosomes. All of you understand, of course, the chromosomes are really the part of the cell where poorly information is kept and why damage to chromosomes can be so important. This is just illustrates an interesting example of what we can do now. All the chromosomes of a particular person have been taken, this is taken from a medical textbook, and you can light up using something called FISH, which is fluorescent in situ hybridization, but you can go fishing inside a gene, inside a carrot, inside chromosomes, and this person shows up homozygous, meaning they have two copies of the Huntington's chorea gene. So this is actually not very happy news this person's about to receive. And Huntington's disease can be obviously very debilitating, life-threatening. So we can start to find genes on chromosomes, not just look at chromosomes, and here are some more chromosomes briefly for you to look at. Looks complicated, it's not. Just count, make the numbers count. There's four examples in each of these numbers here, because we're looking at four of the great apes, starting, well, not so great apes, Homo sapiens here on the left, and then we have the chimp, Androglodytes, gorilla, which is a gorilla, and then the orangutan. Just so each of these is, so it's human, chimp, gorilla, orangutan. And you can see as you count up all the way, you get to 22. So all of these four species have 22 chromosomes, and then, depending on the sex of the animal, 2X for female version, or an X and a Y chromosome for the male version. And can you just see how incredibly similar? So when someone says, well, you know, we share 98% of our genetic material with a chimp, absolutely we do. We really do, and it shows at the chromosome level. There's a really interesting thing here on chromosome 2, where humans have undergone, a long time ago, a fusion between two chromosomes to make one chromosome. And in fact, we call one end of our chromosome P and one end of it Q. And these are the P equivalents and Q equivalents in the other three chromosomes. So we can start to look at genomes in terms of sequence and start to look at them in terms of how they differ and how they're similar. And this is knowledge, I guess. As a scientist, as a Christian, to me it's fascinating and interesting that we can spot similarities and differences, because it tells us a great deal, and I'll come to that in a moment. This is my PhD student, Claire. And the reason I bought a calculator is because I just wanted to do a quick calculation to just to show you again how, when we're trying to sequence the DNA, we have all these chromosomes here, and we're going to start trying to get all the information in chromosome 1 for humans, all the information in chromosome 2 and 3 and 4, all the way up here, how long would that take? So current in-lab sequencing reactions, you can do them in a day, and you can put them in a sequencing box, and you can get about 800 is the read length. A, G, C, and T. So I can tell you at the end of one day, if I had a piece of DNA, what order the A's, G's, and C's, and T's work. And to save a lot of time, my calculator's gone to sleep. But basically, the calculation you do is... just to show you what that looks like. So this is an electropherogram. What happens if you put a piece of DNA into a DNA sequencer? And a DNA sequencer is just a box with a lot of clever stuff in it and chemicals and things. And it will spit out the sequence, and here is the sequence running up this way. TACC, GAGCT, and DNA boring. It just goes on and on and on. I tell my undergraduates that DNA is a very boring molecule, and it has to be for a reason. It has to be chemically very unreactive, because it's an information, like the magnetic stripes on my hard drive, parts of my hard drive. It has to be in either this state or that state. It can't just be kind of wobbling around. So, this is a DNA sequence, and some of you will have seen this before, and you read the DNA sequence by running gels. So this is why I don't believe it's slave labour. If I took the size of the human genome, so all of the DNA in those 23 pairs of chromosomes I showed you earlier, there's 3 billion bases, 3 billion characters I need to read. And I can get a read length of, let's say, 500. I've zoomed it out a bit here, but this goes on for miles and miles. About 500 or so bases in one day. And let's assume, so that gives me something in the order of 6 million sequencing runs that I need to run. Now, each one takes about 2 hours, if I'm being fairly generous. And then we divide by hours and days. And it comes out at about 1,300 years that Claire would have to spend. Now, I don't believe in slave labour, because even for a PhD, I think 1,300 years is a little bit long. So this is really a story. Genomes and understanding genomic sequences is a story of technology. I'll be absolutely frank about it. It's to do with mathematicians, computer scientists, physicists, because what you need to sequence a human genome, the size of a human genome, 3 billion, 3 1,000 million basis is some pretty industrial science stuff. And really about 20 years ago, John Solston and others who've been at Cambridge at the World Contrast Sequencing Centre and others in America started to get together technology to start sequencing the human genome. And they knew that they weren't going to sequence it at the rate they started at. It was going very, very slowly. And technology improved and improved. And I just want to flash up behind what you need. It's a lot of technology, a lot of computing power. Both these pictures are taken from the Sanger Centre, World Contrast Sequencing Centre in Cambridge. So these boxes here you can see are DNA sequences, aircraft hangar sized, room full of DNA sequences connected to another enormous amount of bioinformatics to store and process the data. It has a life of its own, DNA sequencing. Those of you who know about it will recognise some of these words. Please just ignore everything else. The cost per base is one of those things of how much does it cost to get an A or G or C or T. And this is a fascinating, if you look at the graph in 1980, of the cost per base, it's come down from hundreds of dollars to fractions of a cent now. Tiny fractions of a cent, because the technology is so fast at sequencing, and I'm not going to go into it because I did think about it, but it takes away from the fact that it's the story I want to tell you. So it has its own ontology, it has its own kind of language, DNA sequencing, being able to sequence genomes. So let's have a quick look at some genomes. So here's 1990. Genome sequencing begins. John Solston and others at Cambridge started to think, can we sequence the human genome? Because, boy, we want to get at some of the diseases. We want to try and understand why it is that we can use animal models to do various studies, and is there a gene in yeast or fly that we can compare to humans and so on. So it started, and then as technology rapidly caught up, and sequencing started to appear. About the year 2000, the announcement was made by President Clinton and Tony Blair of the draft human genome, and then sort of every couple of months following that until about 2003, it was the final, and the final human Homo sapiens, and the final. It's still not final. There are still gaps in our knowledge of the human genome, because there are some really difficult sections to the sequence, very difficult for various reasons. But it's pretty good, it's pretty close now. So, and you can see that, I mean, this goes to 2007, 2008, so I'm still missing, 4 or 5 years now. Every month, it seems, another genome comes out, and another one, because you can sequence these very fast. And the sequencers are able to spit out DNA at a tremendous rate. So technology and science and biology coming together there. And just to tell you a brief bit about the human genome story, because it's a really interesting one in its own right, because there is something sort of to say here about Christianity and its application in science. Some of you will be aware that there are actually two horses in the race. There was the public face, which was Francis Collins. By chance, happy coincidence, he's a Christian who written some fantastic books, recommend them to you. And this guy, J. Craig Venter, of Celera Genomics in Rockland, Maryland, who decided, right, we'll do this all privately, and we'll try. And in 1998, he applied for 6,000 patents for human genes. So if there were patents for genes for all sorts of things, disease-associated genes. And that was overturned, thankfully, because the public effort and scientists managed to overturn it. But together, it's a happy ending to the story. The public project sort of triumphed, I'd say, in the sense that J. Craig Venter's group had to use some of the public information to get to their final destination as well, which is the entire complement of the human genome. So in its own right, a really interesting story, and recommend those books by Francis Collins. If you were to write all those 3 billion base pairs out in a long line and then sort of taped together in a big circle, and you were to look at the sequences in there that actually do stuff, things that make proteins, so proteins that like hemoglobin, or enzymes that are responsible for signaling cascades inside a cell, or enzymes that copy DNA, or enzymes, or proteins that are antibody molecules, and so on, thousands of different jobs for proteins that make a cell a cell. They actually only turn out to be, it's a little bit higher than this actually, it's about 2%. 2% makes you, sitting in a chair. The rest of it is made up of stuff. The media's called it junk DNA, and that's not true. I don't think it's there as junk. It has functions, some of which we do know about. These things, transposons, are jumping genes, and they're actually very useful for working out part of the evolution of organisms. So these are genes that have jumped in and out of the human genome and others, and you can follow back in time when and where those jumping genes came in. They don't do anything for us, they're hitching a ride. Others hitching a ride, duplications of DNA, large sections of the chromosomes, just simply repetitions of DNA that don't do anything. The microsatellites I'll come on to shortly because they're actually quite interesting, but they don't do anything. And transcribed into RNA as end products, these do. These are molecules of RNA which have some function in the cell, but not always a direct function in the cell. So we're made up of DNA. We contain an awful lot of information coded in our DNA. Each cell of you contains the DNA, but not a lot of it does anything. Please don't read this. This won't be on the end of term paper. But we've got organisms here coming down. Some of them you'll recognise in just a moment. And I've put the number of base pairs and the number of genes here. There's a rough correlation between the size of an organism and the number of genes or the size of its genome. Very roughly, that's true. The bigger you are, the more genes you need. And that's about right. But it's not completely true. Here's wheat down here. It has 30,000 genes. You know, 5,000 or so more than we do. And it has the size of its genome, 16 billion base pairs, just for wheat. So organisms don't necessarily correlate the size and number of genes, but they do roughly. Let's have a quick look at some of these. So influenza A is one that you'll know is a very rapidly evolving a flu virus. It was the World Health Organization have to make a guess every year as to which antibodies to make for that, for the influenza vaccines. They get it right some years, but not always. But it only has 10 genes, enough to make you poorly with 10 genes, because basically it gets into your cells and hijacks your cells. E. coli, that's the bacteria some people know as nasty stuff, but we know in labs very well-tamed E. coli. Has a genome here of 4.5 million, I'm sure you earlier, and about 4,000 genes. And here we are with our 3 billion base pairs and 25,000 genes. 25,000 isn't much, but it spawns really, since these have started coming out, they're coming out faster and faster, the whole field of genomics. So what is genomics? And it's enough to make your head do this, I think, sometimes. Because once you get to a stage of information with so many genomes, each of which has all this information, how on earth do you go about ordering it? And there's something there, isn't there, about keeping things ordered, keeping understanding how things fit together, because only then can work out how it works. I'll just flick you through a few screen prints. Really important thing are that technology has kept pace with the amount of information, and there are now some very, very good genome browsers. You can go and look at these afterwards if you have 2 seconds. Basically, there's some pretty serious computing going on there. And this is the one that I recommend many of my students, some of them might nod that they know about this one, the NCBI Entree website. Inside here, it's a curated database that stores annotates information from genomes and all sorts of other things. It's a database of databases, and if you click on this one that just says genome, you come to another page that says genome. This resource organises information on genomes by sequences, maps, chromosomes and those sort of things. And within there, there's one called the human genome, although I can click on bacteria or the genome of things like chloroplasts or mitochondria, plants, viruses and all sorts of other things. So these, without the web, the World Wide Web, it'd be impossible, I think, to understand and get some real power out of this genomic technology. So the web is a yes. We like the World Wide Web. It's a fantastic resource for distributing information free. This is all free, as it should be in science. So if I click on human genome, it brings me to the front page of human genome. There are the chromosomes laid out in ideograms. And there's our 22 chromosomes that make all of us human. And then an X and a Y for male, or double X if you're female. If you can just click on them, so it's kind of a Google interface, everything's clickable, lots of information, lots of names of things. This is the online Mendelian inheritance in man. This is a fascinating database that contains information on genetic diseases in humans, correlating with where they sit in the human genomes and places. So if I clicked on chromosome 16, it would take me to another level, and it brings me to chromosome 16 here, which has banding pattern, which has been well known for decades and decades. If you just stain chromosomes, they stain up these beautiful bands. But now we have all this information on where the genes sit. Notice it in the middle here, where the two halves of the chromosome are joined, not hardly any genes at all. And within here, there are thousands of genes. All of them are now annotated. So many genes, we don't know what they do. And this is really, we should confess our ignorance to quite what they do. Many of the ones that we do know what they do, they'll actually put in here. So I'm going to zoom in on hemoglobin in just a moment. But you can see there are binding proteins here and genes associated with all sorts of other things in the cell. So if I was to zoom in again now on the part of the chromosome 16 that shows me where one of the hemoglobin chains that I told you about hemoglobin earlier, that's the one that carries oxygen. So click on that again, I zoom in, it's just like a Google Earth map, but zooming in on a quite different scale, right in on the chromosome, and I've looked up section 210 to 240,000. It's just a small section within the entire chromosome, and I've come across the gene for, probably on there somewhere, hemoglobin alpha 1, there it is there. So, if I was a researcher, this kind of information is very, very useful. Joseph and others probably, hopefully, realise with me how useful it is to have sequences of genes, known positions. So, hemoglobin, we'll come back to a little bit later, but this is one of the subunits of hemoglobin, and you can look at various other, this interesting locus here, the various hemoglobin residues, so this particular tiny point, one chromosome, not so. So the question becomes, how do we use knowledge for benefit? And that's a question that could sit on any discipline, I suppose, not just this. How do we use this knowledge for benefit? Can we start comparing genomes to find out what it is that human genes do, but also what are the nasties that give us flu and other diseases and things? Can we start to find out what genes are involved there? Because if we find the genes, then we can find the proteins. And if we can find the proteins, we can make some vaccines, or we can make antibiotics, or we can make antivirals for HIV, and so on and so on. So comparing genomes is a very, very powerful way of finding out how we work, how things work. It's a bit like shopping around, I suppose. You find out various prices and how various other organisms do it. The title here is a 16S rRNA. Please, you don't need to know that. But if I start with a huge family here of organisms, which have different lengths, but I can now use a computer to start comparing them all and say, oh, there's a section there that looks just like a section of that organism. Isn't that weird? And so on, and that's called blasting your sequence, and you can look at sequences. And if you blast the sequence, where you line them all up for every organism that has had its genome sequenced, you come up with a crazy slide. But the most important point is, the red dots here are probably where in evolution a common ancestor has diverged or split. And I just want to show you really that that life is made up of bacteria. It's made up of more bacteria. It's made up of lots and lots of things that aren't the other plants down there. And then we're metazoans that long way down this sort of, it's called, it's not really a tree of life, it's more a herb of life. It's kind of a low, stunted bush. But way off down here. Now isn't that interesting, because we have to recognise our place on the planet as the top predator, I suppose, the thing that we are actually changing the climate, we're changing the world around us, but we don't sit at the top of a tree of life, as was called the Christmas tree of life, we visualised in previous generations. In times gone past, we can start to compare sequences using this particular sequence. I should sort of say this sequence here, everything has. So that's a great sequence to compare, that's why I'm doing this. You can compare the sequence of this particular RNA across everything. And there's evidence that somewhere back in the ancient bacteria here, that mitochondria, which we all have, which are these power factories inside our cells, came from bacteria tens of millions of years ago. Chloroplasts in plants also. At some point you can find sequences that look so similar, you think, oh, that must have been when chloroplasts came across into landfills. So it's very powerful. And this is just, I like this picture, taken from one of my biochemistry textbooks in Leninger. It's a picture of the Garden of Eden by a Dutch painter called Jan van Kessel, the younger. Look this up online, he was an astonishingly good artist. This is just a section of one of the corners. Here's Adam and Eve here. And I think that's true, isn't it? We understand that life is completely diverse on this planet. It's full of niches, every single niche is filled with life. So, and it's a biblical view of creation, that everything was good, everything worked together, and that this great diversity and a great unity in life as well. That's simple, A-G-C-T. I can't think of anything more simple than four letters that bring us all together, everything. There is an element of this in it, though. We're not solving hunger, and we're not going to cure diabetes just by looking at this kind of these sequences and thinking, well, you know, so what? So, to the so what part, I just want to spend the last section. Well, how long do I have? 10? About 5? 5 minutes more. Okay, that's great, because I'll actually just flip for a few and then stop. The so what part is really the bit that I want to talk, discuss and debate with you. I'll tell you a quick story about so what. Why is it important that having these sequences is going to revolutionise medicine for a start over the next decade or so? Well, here's me down in the corner, and my good old dad has been doing some Genes Reunited stuff. And you can follow my dad and my mum. Some of you have probably done this already. It's absolutely fascinating. After a while, obviously their names become meaningless because you don't know who they were. But we're going back in time, sort of a couple of hundred years. And if you follow this arrow up, boom, 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 I can trace back a George Gow. I can trace my dad traced back a George Gow's to 1714, which is kind of fun. But tracing stuff back takes you only as far as a certain distance. This building here goes back, I'm sure, further than that. So, can we use sequences to trace back in time? And the answer is yes. This is my colleague Paul. He travels on the train with me, and he's a scientist like me, and he's done some really serious looking at his own DNA to try and work out where he come from, what sort of clans did he come from. So I'll tell you his story quickly. So as you know, that men are XY, and women are from Venus. And mitochondrial DNA here is another source of DNA. And just going back to that slide I showed you earlier, do you remember that 2% of DNA that's actually translated into something useful? All this rest of this stuff turns out to be rather useful for tracking generations, for evolution in its fullest sense, back through the years. So Paul has done some really interesting work on his Y chromosome, mitochondrial DNA, send samples off to places like Oxford Ancestors, and if you know that around here, and you know, companies like that. I just need to tell you that inside all this junk DNA, there are things called single nucleotide polymorphisms. These are changes. About every 1,000 bases, every 1,000 AGCTs, you and I are different at one point, and then another 1,000. On average, it's not actually even, but it's about that. So if we want to try and trace things back, we could sequence as many people as we can, line them all up, do this blast search, and find out how we're all different. And that would be wonderful, but it would cost millions and millions of pounds in at the moment. So do we look at all of them, all of these things, and they're SNPs, so they're nice things to look at. Last is SNP. Do we look at all of them? The answer is no. We look at groups of them. And if you look at clusters, because they're distributed non-evenly throughout the entire genome, you can start to match up samples from people going back in time. Obviously, I don't want you to read all this. The point is that Paul has discovered that his haplogroup, which is a collection of SNPs, basically, R1D, and mitochondrial DNA, his haplogroup H, which is actually quite a general one, because with mitochondrial DNA, it's actually harder to get high resolution. But he's worked out that he has an Italo-Celtic branch. And what's exciting, just remind you, the haplogroup is a collection of SNPs. It's a collection of repetitive DNA that's usually inherited intact. So down the generations, it doesn't get mixed up during sexual combination and meiosis. It stays together down the years. So these are called haplogroups. Some of you have heard of haplogroups, maybe. And you can have your haplotype. You can be haplotyped. All these various loci. These are points within his genome. So you've taken a mouth swab, and they've tested these 37 points on his Y chromosome, which is specific to men, of course, women don't have them. And from that, worked out what group he was. The exciting thing is when you start mapping these, looking at people from all over Europe and all over the world, and you can start to map what clan did I come from about 5, and he's about 5,000 years ago, 5,300 years ago. So he reckons that his clan probably sort of here from France, possibly they came up through Ireland, he finds that that's really interesting. So that's DNA genomes, that's a bit of a so what. You can go back in time much more than that, and if you start to trace the types of people that are existing today, all around the world, you can start to track from those many millions of years ago to just a few tens of thousands of years ago, probably how humans have went out around the world. This is taken from a paper a little bit earlier. Ice Age 20,000 years ago has forced people south. And then about 15,000 years ago, just more diversion and filling up all the various parts of the planet, go forth and multiply. And we did. So, yeah. So this is quite a powerful way. You look at those SNPs, people's DNA, and you can all go and take your sample of DNA, it's a mouth swab, and find out which group you're part of. And that's very useful for tracking populations. And I think I'll tell you maybe two more slides, or two or three more slides, max. Tell you the story of Barbary macaques. These are chimps, really, that live, macaques that live on Gibraltar. And the question arose, can we look at where they came from? Because during the Second World War, they were down to just a few left. And Winston Churchill said that we mustn't let the macaques disappear from Gibraltar. It's crucial for morale, apparently. So the question became, I don't quite know why that is, 2005, where do they come from? Because you only find macaques in the wild in these sort of two parts, Algeria and Morocco. And the way that they did this was to look at these SNPs and put them into haplo. Into haplogroups, and they used the mitochondrial DNA of these founding populations. And you can see in green, these are what the macaques in Gibraltar, the haplogroups they have. And it actually turns out that probably the people who were sent off to try and get these macaques went to both populations in the end. There isn't a full green on one branch or full green on the other branch. But you can start to work out where the animals have come from, where their history is, which is quite useful in conservation places. Other things that genes do that have started to get a bit more interesting. This is social feeding with a tiny little worm called C. elegans, it's only a millimetre or so across. And the Australian sort, no, big one, this is the British sort, live free living in the soil. When they feed on the crop, they will disperse happily. But the Australian sort like to live at the edges here, and they congregate in a social behaviour. You think this is, they're not talking to each other, and they're not feeding each other with spoons, but there's a social element to their behaviour, because it's a particular neuropeptide, that if you knock it out, if you take it away, put it back in, you can make this behaviour just simply split between these two forms here. So that's genes doing actual behaviour stuff, and there's loads more that genes do, lots and lots more this is a very nasty disease, working out how it works, linked to particular protein disorder and jet lag and so on. Schizophrenia are particularly occur because they're particularly sensitive to dopamine in the brain, a particular receptor, schizophrenia and so on. So genes have a big effect on us, but we're not ruled by our genes. I don't think God made us to be ruled by our genomes. We are products of our environment and other things as well. We can follow evolution of genes a long way back in time. And this is an ancestral globe, and I'll finish on that just in the next slide. You can follow, this is millions of years here, so back about a billion years, you can see how genes split. So this is starting to get interesting as well, because you can start to follow which organisms have genes where, and which organisms you might be able to target if you're looking for a disease target to get to, which ones will work, which ones don't. And this is actually human chromosomes here. So these are all human chromosomes. Chromosome 16 and 11 are the ones where we actually make the hemoglobin that makes us in our blood. I'll probably finish on this one, just to say that genomics actually plays an important founder role. And as usual, I think the government got a bit bored when they went back and said, well, now we need to work out the proteome, or the intermediate bit, which is the transcriptome and proteome and so on, leading from one full set of information, the genome, to the next set, which is what is all the RNA that's made, the transcriptome, to proteomes. What are all those proteins? Even though there's only 2% of them. And here are two that are interesting. Here's chromosome 11, chromosome 16 again, we saw earlier. And at small clusters on these, we have genes for adult, fetal, and infant hemoglobin. And what happens in fetal life, so in the womb, hemoglobin has to suck the oxygen from the maternal blood supply much more tightly, because the mum uses the oxygen up herself, of course, so the fetus has to grab as much oxygen, and they have very highly specific proteins that then get switched off in the first couple of months of life, and you go into infant form, which is sort of two blues and a purple. But then there are diseases in which the hemoglobinopathies, in which the various beta globins don't get expressed properly, and I don't know if anyone knows of anyone with some of these various thalassemias, but they can be very nasty. But because we now know the DNA sequence of these various genes, we're able to work on proteins that perhaps could be used to it's a supplemental supply. I think that's more than enough for me to have talked. I've got more slides, but can I jump towards the end and some of the issues that I'd really like to talk about, perhaps in discussion, is think about genomics as a topic for, you know, how some things are ingrained, whether just us, your eye colour, your hair, and so on, your height. If anyone's interested in what epigenetics is, it's the next example of thing. So lots of our money here. What do we do as stewards of creation? Really interesting to debate that with you, because I know we all have to look after our planet, our families, ourselves. What are the limits of scientific questions? Are we ever going to get there with biology? Should we be pushing this far? And then these genetic engineering and modification and so on. Really important, I think, to have voices and value as Christians as well. Voices meaning organisations that are able to reflect, like this one, you know, thoughtfully and carefully on advances in science or in other disciplines as well. When there's a challenge comes up, like xenotransplantation, which is moving organs perhaps from people who are dying or nearly dead and so on, or growing new organs in other organisms, beings and so on. What do we think? What do we make? What kind of moral structure, framework should we have in place as Christians to better deal with some of these issues that will get really important over the next decade as personal medicine and personal sequencing comes into school? $1,000 genome will be with us very shortly. That's a prize issued by the X something or other foundation in America. The first person who can you can give them a sample of your swab from your mouth or something, and they can sequence your entire DNA genome for $1,000. That will get more and more. I think, you know, 10 or 20 years, you go to the doctors, they'll ask what your metabolome is, what bacteria live inside you, and not just your blood pressure. We'll take your metabolome, we'll take your human genome, and we'll work out with pharmacogenomics what drugs to give you so that you don't get a bad reaction, plus all the many, hopefully many good drugs that will be coming as a consequence of this research. Okay. Many thanks for your time. Sorry, it's a bit long.
Let's thank Ralph. And I'm sure you'll be happy to take questions. So.
Yeah. Sit first. Thank you for your patience. It's very warm up here. Feel free to stretch your legs, please do, if you need to.
Genetic modification, if we can, I've got some slides on it earlier, but if you can modify an organism so that it either survives better in its environment, or you can modify an animal to secrete, I don't know if any of you saw the picture of the silk, what was it called, silk goat was only a few weeks ago, about a goats which have been modified to secrete into their milk, spider proteins, that's what it's
called. Yeah, spider silk. Yeah.
Spider silk, wasn't it? So genetically modified. Now, my take as a Christian is, I think, you know, along the lines of do no harm, I think, which is a kind of a medical take on it a little bit, isn't it? I have no problems with it in that I don't think human cloning and the technologies which are associated with garage science probably will ever come about, because of course we'd be completely against those being unique individuals. But doing good means new vaccines and things, research on. Can we ask, bring the animals question in here, research on animals? I don't know, there's probably a wide range here, but animal research, as long as it's done, again, you know, as good stewards, carefully looking after animals for research, I think, probably, I have no objection to. Genetic modification, when it comes to things like food, I think we can grow enough, don't you? I mean, do we need to have seeds from Monsanto that you can't germinate the next year, that you have to go back and farm? Is there a point there where we need to say, look, that's enough, we should be doing good here, that we're not doing good with this financial gain? And genetic modification in some cases, I think, would be fine in terms of research, medical developments and so on. But they're tiny steps, aren't they? You're never going to take a step from here to get a cure for cancer.
it just never happens. There's so many steps and there are more between. Sometimes they involve experiments in animals. Experiments on humans, experiments on students sometimes, the medical students, you know, they offer themselves as living examples. I don't know, what do others think? Please, my voice is getting boring.
We have another question?
Yeah, can I had a question, but now that you have asked the question, can I just comment and a question on that? So I'm from Oklahoma, in the States, which is the buckle of the Bible Belt region. And stem cell research, there's no public funding for stem cell research. Mm-hmm. And that has gone through the state government clearance that there shouldn't be any stem cell funding. But a ton of research immediately benefits. Stem cell therapy research immediately benefits neurological diseases. I mean, 17 patients currently have been treated with stem cell therapy for cardiopathology.
For growing a new trachea is one you think about.
Well, the trachea one, that was done in Karolinska Institute, but I'm talking about cardiac scars, actually heart muscle scars.
Oh, sorry,
that was about 17 patients that have been gone through that. So, I mean, those are just some examples. Yeah. So, how do you juxtapose, I mean, you were just talking about juxtaposing those two together. I mean, that's for the audience as well, not just for you.
I'd love to hear your comments. The one about stem cells, where do they, I mean, can I just add the comment that stem cells, there are various ways that you can get stem cells, or there are cells that can be divided, that can be simulated to divide into liver and heart and blood and all sorts of tissues that we need. So in theory, you can use them to grow a new heart, grow new tissues and so on, and repair damage. And Christopher Reeve, of course, from the Superman films, has died now, but a great proponent of stem cell research and embryonic stem cell research. So there's a big one for us to think about. Do we use embryos from IVF that would just be thrown away? Do we try and push on to get stem cells from inside our bones? Can we? Because stem cells sort of are all over our body. Just every, I don't know what the density is, but we're sort of one cell every million or so is a stem cell. And in fact, that's what keeps us in white and red blood cells. Stem cells inside our bones, continually generating new red blood cells and white blood cells, or continually dividing. So stem cells keep us going. What do I think about it? I think it sounds good to me. The embryonic thing is difficult. That's difficult, but probably surmountable. I think, I don't know what your thoughts are, but getting stem cells from other sources potentially really powerful.
So you are for the ban?
For the no, sorry, not. Well, I don't know whether. So Obama hasn't overturned it. So it came in George Bush's
terms. Well, they, at the federal level, they're but on the state
level,
they're
not funding it. I would fund it. In the UK, there's no ban.
Yeah, I know.
Newcastle, I think, is a big one, isn't it? I think as a Christian, good stuff there. Do no harm, we're doing good, hopefully. Who will know?
I'm from the States as well. I'm from Colorado. And I worked as an assistant in a laboratory that collected stem cells from cord blood transplants.
Yes, okay, fine.
So we can help leukemia patients and that sort of thing. But we didn't ever really discuss, you know, the difference between cord blood transplants versus, you know, stem cells from cord bloods versus those from embryos. Do you know much about the difference?
Because I'm not a medical doctor, I don't know a lot, but it seems to me that cord blood, if you can collect it safely, because again, relatively invasive technique, was it relatively safe?
It was actually very safe. We would collect the cord blood after the mother.
Oh, sorry, after birth, after parturition. Mm-hmm. Right, beg your pardon. And yes, the number of stem cells in cord blood, I think, is much lower. Not an expert, but again, that sounds useful. So this whole idea of stem cell banks for each human, so that we have some DNA stored at birth, we have some stem cells stored at birth in nitrogen. Well, you know, we're going down some rather science fiction routes there, aren't we? Maybe you would need them when you're 17. You need a new heart. You need a new.
But in fact, I think last term weekend, what's the guy's name again? John Wyatt. You mentioned he's a medical doctor.
Right,
Dr. John Wyatt. And he mentioned that you get this whole rhetoric, right, in medicine about, okay, the human body is bad, the human body is flawed, therefore science can help.
Yes, yeah.
Which is quite different in some thinkings from what the Bible says, isn't it?
We're special, we're each unique.
Or even that suffering has a place in human experience.
That's a wonderful debate. Thankfully, I'm not too qualified to speak on it, but the suffering in the world. Well, let's try and reduce it in every field that we work in, whether you're economics, social sciences, wherever you are, what we can do to help do together. And Christians have got a big voice in the next decade. We need to use it, you know, voices and values. Really recommend the London Institute of Christianity. Christians and Science is an absolutely ace website and an ace organisation. And Faraday and others do very good work as well. Thank you very much for your time, for staying awake.
They give you one last thing. So I'm sure you'll be around for a while.
Yes, of course, yeah.
One last thing.